Welcome to Talk Write Done, the show where we talk about everything you need to know about writing for your coaching or educational business. Whether your work in progress is a blog post, an article, or a book, here you'll find the inspiration, motivation, and expertise you need to help you succeed. I'm your host, writing coach, editor, and applied linguist, Dr. Lissy Tangi, and I'm dedicated to helping business owners like you harness the power of the written word to reach more people and transform more lives. Join me as I chat to writing and publishing experts, as well as business owners at various stages of the writing process. I'm just as interested in getting started and the messy middle as I am in the finished product. So wherever you are in your writing journey, you'll find what you need here. So pull up a chair, pour yourself a cuppa, and let's get started. As writers and business owners, one of the most important things we can do to stand back and reflect and pause can sometimes feel really counterintuitive. But I know for me, this is when the biggest breakthroughs happen. You know, I often feel like the best writing happens when I'm away from the screen. So I was so excited to talk to today's guest, author and absolute expert in finding that place of calm and clarity in our minds, Dr. Sarah Beth Hunt. Sarah writes fiction and nonfiction and is the founder of Messy Luminous Beings, a yoga and meditation platform. She's also the host of her podcast, Messy Luminous Beings, where she has inspirational conversations about weaving spiritual practice into messy real life. In this episode, we chatted about Sarah's latest book, Forward From Here, Spiritual Vision in Pandemic Times, exploring the question of how we create and live and love as we move forward from COVID-19. Sarah shared her lessons learned, talked about what meditation does for her writing habits as a prolific writer, business owner, and mother of young children, and how we can all ensure that we're writing for the long game in our business.
Okay, so hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Lizzie.
Oh, no problem. I'm excited about this conversation. I'll just give listeners a bit of context. So Sarah and I are actually writing accountability buddies. So we met through a writing group and we've been meeting weekly, pretty much, with a few gaps, haven't we, for a while. So yeah, I'm really excited to hear more about your writing and your book, your latest book particularly. So yeah. So if you could start by telling us who you work with and why you started your business, first of all, and then we'll dive into your book if that's okay.
Yeah, great. So I founded a company called Messy Luminous Being, and it's a yoga and meditation platform that has a podcast, it has online courses and memberships and that kind of thing. But writing has been, I would say, like my great love. And so for me, always my question, because I trained, as you know, as an academic originally. And so I did my PhD at Cambridge in Indian studies. And I have this random book out through an academic press about Hindi literature, which is sort of hilarious.
I know you had an academic background, but I didn't realize you had that book until I was Googling you to do your, you know, just before we started this. Oh, you kept that one a secret. Yeah.
Well, so, you know, it's not really what I do now, but I think my academic training was the thing that really helped me the most, because I've always written, Lizzie, like in, you know, middle school, I was like, you know, organizing the creative writing book for the year in our class and stuff. So and when I first moved over to Britain, I remember my husband, well, he wasn't my husband then, but, you know, we moved to Cambridge for his job. And I thought, you know, I just graduated from uni and I was like, oh, living in a foreign country, this sounds excellent and exciting. And I'll go there for 6 months. And, you know, here I still am. But I remember him walking out of the house for his job and thinking, oh, what am I going to do? And what I did was go to the coffee shop and start writing my first book, which never, you know, this isn't a book that I've actually ever published. It was the book that I was writing like when I was 21. It will never see the light of day. I don't even know where it is, but it was, you know, writing has always been the place where I think best. Mm. You know, I'm one of these people, I've always had journals going off and on my whole life. And so I guess it's just an evolving relationship for me about what I'm writing about. But writing is sort of, yeah, I see myself sort of, this is my career, really.
Yeah.
My life, I think.
Fantastic. Thank you. So your latest book, you wrote in response. Is it fair to say it was in response to the pandemic?
Yeah.
I think, yeah. So your latest book is called Forward From Here. And it's an exploration of how we might use our experiences, including those that are really hard and uncertain and uncomfortable, as opportunities for greater inner understanding, growth and transformation.
Yeah. So I wrote that book after the first year. Mm-hmm. You know, by the time we had sort of gotten our feet really wet into what it meant to be in the pandemic, and we also didn't necessarily know how much longer it was going to go on. And I sort of started, you know, I think we all did, didn't we? We started having these sort of epiphany moments about our life, whether that was how busy we were, or whether that was how hard it is to be alone, or whether that's, you know, what we missed and what we actually didn't miss anymore. And for me, I started having these sort of reflections. And I also knew that eventually, my own training in meditation and yoga, there's this sort of underlying the idea of impermanence, that everything is impermanent. So I knew the pandemic was eventually going to go away, you know, and eventually we were going to have the opportunity to go back to some kind of life that looks similar to the one that we had been living up until that point. And so I guess for me, the book Forward From Here was really like my own process of answering the question, or just even asking the question, what am I learning? What are my reflections about the life that I had been living, the other opportunities or options or ways of living that might be possible, and the things that I want to not forget once this is all over. And it was funny because, you know, I wrote that book a year in, and obviously we're really only now, I feel like, getting to the point where people are, you know, really finally getting used to not wearing masks. And, you know, we're really moving towards, you know, people are going to the cinema, they're going to all these like big events. And maybe I wonder if now is even a better time to be reflecting on this question, you know.
Maybe it's time for the next book.
there's always the next book.
That's right. Oh, it's so interesting because I mean I absolutely had that period of reflection during the pandemic, and you know I don't even think I'd be here running my business, having started this podcast. I kind of, you know, all that kind of homeschooling, being at home, say gave me time. I didn't have any time, but just space for reflection, standing back and thinking, is this really what I want?
Yeah.
Is that what I want?
That's it. I mean, you're like me in the sense that we both have young kids. You know, I have an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old, and that's, you know, after 2 years of pandemic. So, you know, they were young. Mm-hmm. But I think that although the pandemic for us and people in our situation didn't give us more time, it gave us a different kind of time.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
It gave us a different relationship with time where, although there was always something going on or someone needing something, we also weren't rushing anywhere.
That was right, wasn't it? Wasn't having to rush and leave the house and go to different activities and all of that stuff.
Or even to have your head full of schedule.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And who do you need to meet and who do, and all the social arrangements and just kind of stepping back from that as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so you start your book by talking about wild swimming, which I really loved. And I know that when we've met before for writing sessions, so I should say you live in Scotland, don't you? So the water, if you go swimming in Scotland in a loch, it's really cold, isn't it? It's not, you know, I live close to the sea in Wales, but I can imagine your water is much colder than ours.
It does get cold. Well, so when the pandemic started, I was down south in England. So we've just moved to Scotland. So when I started swimming, most of my swimming has actually been done in Scotland, but I'm from Florida, Lizzie. So cold water swimming was like the antithesis of what I thought I would be doing.
Yeah.
I think the reason I started the book with that is because sometimes we need a little example, or sometimes I need a little example to look at how a process works so that I can then apply it to bigger and much more complicated examples, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think for me, cold water swimming, there were a couple of lessons that I sort of took away, especially from the first time I ever got in. Like, that was the biggest eye opener. And I went in this morning, and you know, I'm still going in once a week, and I'm sort of getting to the point now where I've swum almost every week, apart from the COVID weeks, every week of the year. But it was really that first one or two times getting in the water and realizing that there was something beyond the initial harshness and discomfort, that if you stuck with it just a little bit longer, and I've heard other people like in the entrepreneurial space talk about this, like Tony Robbins, for instance, for anyone who's familiar with him and the whole self-development thing, he often talks about this in terms of, you know, you can be, you know, poor at something, good at something, excellent at something, and or outstanding is what he calls the top. And he said, there's a big jump between poor and good, and there's a big jump between good and excellent. But the jump between excellent and outstanding is tiny. And you just need that little tiny bit more than most people. You know, and there is that about the cold water swimming as well. And there is this about meditation. If you just stick with something that's uncomfortable a little bit longer than your body wants to, because in the cold water, you get in and your body takes over from the mind. You know, you can sort of get yourself in there, but as soon as that cold water hits you, especially like in your chest, when you've gotten all the way in, it's like I had this automatic reaction that wasn't even a thought. It was my body thinking for me, like, let's get the, you know, whatever out of here.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was really that first time my husband, who's a born Scot, so he's got the cold blood in him, and he was like, swim, swim, this is a swim. And I was like, oh, you know, he kind of cut through the white noise that had just covered my mind from the initial discomfort of the cold. And once I started kind of just, you know, swimming is like, I'm putting in air quotations, because it was just a little like, you know, breaststroke kind of paddle around. I'm not like doing anything that I would call exercise, but I stayed in a bit longer and my whole physical experience of the cold water changed, and everything in my body was like a furnace and suddenly heated up, and suddenly my breath calmed down from this like panic breathing to really, really calm. And the effect that I felt inside was totally different between minute one and minute two and a half. You know, that's how small the time was that I needed to stay in just a bit longer.
Yeah.
And I think that's, and what I noticed about that is that I know that that's true with meditation, because I've trained in a traditional form of Tibetan Buddhist meditation. So my training's very traditional, and it's like, in the Kagyu lineage, it's like that. But what I know from years of trying to sit is that your body kind of takes over a little bit, and you just get that restlessness where you just need to get up. And even though your intention was to sit and try to wait it out a little bit longer, your body can't stand not moving and not doing. And so it will get you up. It will find a reason to get up. But if you can endure that discomfort of the restlessness of the body, that urge to sit up, get up, move, do something, accomplish something, and you realize that that's just a discomfort that you don't need to react to, then something different happens in your mind, you know? And so I kind of, taking these two examples, I sort of started to think, like, is this a bigger lesson that we can take from the pandemic? We've been through, you know, when I wrote the book, it was like, we've been through a year, now we've been through two. And there's this, you know, even more than there was before, there's an urge to get up and start doing. And that's, you know, that's amazing. It's like a joy to go to events. It's a joy. Yeah. You know, up here, Kaylee dancing, like group dancing, is such a like fun thing. And you know, my goal this year was like, I want to go to a proper Kaylee again and dance with people.
Mm. Oh, we had one at the weekend with my uncle here. We had a wedding, Kaylee. Yeah, fantastic.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, so, you know, so there's things that we have in our life that the pandemic sort of took away, and we're finding such joy in coming back to them. But there's also that kind of the habits of a lifetime take over again. And so I think it's important for us to think, well, not everyone's going to have the same answer to this question, but it's important for us all to ask it, like, what is it that we've learned here about ourselves, about what we like and what we don't like, and, you know, what's important to us and what's not important to us? For me, some of this question was like, who is important to me and who's not? Yeah. Yeah. Who am I giving a lot of time to that actually I didn't miss, and I felt relief that they, you know, that that relationship wasn't so prominent in my life. And so, you know, I think, you know, like I say, we all have different, we're all different. Some of us are extroverts, some of us are introverts. We're going to, just even that, we're going to have two different responses to what happened. But yeah, I think it's a question that we can keep coming back to, like, even if it's the small things, sometimes the small things are the most important things.
Yeah.
You know?
What would you say the biggest changes that you've made kind of intentionally are since the pandemic?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that one, like, I'm an introvert. Mm. Probably a lot of us listening are introverts.
Oh yeah, I think so. Right? Yeah. No, I totally am.
We tend to be wanting to hide away in a corner and just be with our laptops or our pen and paper and stuff. But so, you know, us as a group, I'm sure that there was a lot of cutting the wheat from the chaff. What busyness did I sort of feel like I had to take on, but then actually I was really relieved it's gone and I'm not letting it back in.
Yes.
You know? But then I think some of this is like a increased motivation from a lot of the intentions that I had with meditation, like to not be busy, to be as less busy as possible. There's no way of not being busy, but to be very, very intentional about what I say yes to. I remember before the pandemic, I read, have you read that book, Essentialism?
Yes.
And that's a
few of them. Yeah.
That's it, Greg McKeown. And he has two chapters about essentialism when it comes to time and like how important it is to recognize that when we're saying yes to something, we're also saying no to other things. And so, you know, so that for me, like a lot of my changes have been around what I say yes to, what I say no to, that kind of thing. I think also the other thing that was sort of in the pipeline, but I hadn't actually implemented or actually made it into a daily practice, was noticing how different activities make me feel energetically. So there are some activities that I love doing, but at the end of them, I'm tired. Mm. Like podcasting is a perfect example. I love both running my own podcast and you know, coming on other people's because I love conversations. But I know that there's a certain energetic cost because I'm more of an introvert that I'm not going to have to, but I'm better when I acknowledge and then accommodate and do like other things that are less outward energetic and put more stuff in me. And we, you know, so I think, you know, the pandemic sort of made me reflect on like, what are those activities? What are the things that make me feel energized and really able to give, like to my kids, to my work, to my partner? And what are those activities that I love to do that I will always have in my life, but which I'm going to have to refill afterwards? So I think those are a couple of things.
Okay, that makes total sense. And the same for me as well with podcasting, actually. It's something that I love to do. But again, it does take that out of you, doesn't it? That kind of outward facing element of it. Yeah, definitely.
We can think about this with writing. You know, there are some types of writing that I just feel like after an hour or two of like sitting in a world that's, you know, not here, I'm like, oh, and there's some stages of the writing process that I absolutely love that are like, after 3 hours of doing it, I feel like on top of the world and I'm ready to kind of give everything to my kids or give everything to somebody who needs me or, you know, whatever. And there are other stages of the writing process that are absolutely tedious and exhausting, and they drain me.
Oh, and interesting. So, yeah. You
know, like finding and just it's not even like knowing the answer right away, but going, ooh, I'm going to watch this and see how I feel before and after an activity. Like, am I looking forward to it? How can I change my energetic state so I can look forward to the things that I have to do? Because that's possible. Even when the things that we have to do are hard and outside our comfort zone, there are methods, you know, with meditation and breathing and visualization that you can change your energetic state so that you feel good going into things. But then also to pay attention to the aftermath, whatever that is, good, bad.
What would you say for someone that thinks they might like to get started with meditation, you know, listening to you thinking, oh, that might really help with some of these things. I want to be more intentional or notice these things about myself. How can people get started? You know, beginner like me, what's the first thing?
Totally. I think the most common thing everyone feels is that they can't meditate. You know, like mind is way too busy. I can't sit still. I hate sitting still. This is not for me. And it's good to know that that's true for everyone. no one naturally feels, because we weren't raised in a culture that taught us how to do that or made us feel proud or good, or, you know, gave us A pluses for how long we could sit and be still and calm the mind. That wasn't, you know, we were like, let's accomplish this, do this, fill out this, you know, what have you done at the end of your day?
Yeah.
We ask ourselves this all the time, like, oh, what did you do today? What did you do today? We very rarely ask, like, how did you feel in your day? Like, I don't even ask that. You know, I ask that of myself, but that's not our question. But that said, and of course, I'm going to say this, Leslie, because although meditation is really hard, meditation as a practice has been the single most transformative practice in my life, above yoga, above all the self-development that I've also done alongside it, more than therapy. I mean, I haven't done much therapy, but there was a time in my life, you know, with my parents' divorce where I was in psychotherapy. And so, but meditation, if you think about it, like everything that you experience in your life is filtered through your mind. What you see, what you hear, what you notice, what you make that mean, all of it comes through the mind. And yet our minds are totally out of control. You know, we can't direct them. If you ever had that thing where this thought that's running through your head is driving you nuts, like if you ever had an argument with someone in your head that's not even there, like, I'm going to say this to them, I can't believe they said that to me, or I can't believe they put me in this position, and I wish I could say this, and you're gone for 10 minutes and you keep repeating that thought, driving yourself crazy, but you can't stop that thought coming back and pulling you away. And we have this happen all the time. And we also have a lot of thoughts. And for me as a writer, and I bet for a lot of people listening, you know, it's the thoughts like that we don't even really let into the conscious mind, but that are there in the background, like a low radio station, just kind of playing away, like, what if no one's going to like this? No one's going to read this. What are people going to think about this? I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not as good as that writer. Like we're not even sure what this voice in our head is saying, but we all have it, and it's whispering to us, and it's whispering in a way that goes straight in to our deep self and takes away the joy, why we started writing in the beginning. You know, our confidence, the love we have of the subject that we're writing about, you know, all of the magic, it kind of takes away. So I feel like for me, meditation, I mean, that's just one example of what it can do. I feel like it has the power to transform every aspect of your life because everything's, translated through the mind. But with writing and with work, I feel like it has had a massive impact on me and how I'm able to show up. So, you know, because we've all had days where we knew what we wanted to say, but we just couldn't get it out onto the page. You know, we just,
Yeah.
The words weren't there. It sounded dumb. We look at our words and they're just awkward and they're not quite right. And we can't, you know, it's like, it's there, but the magic of the trueness of what we're trying to say isn't there. And then we've all had other days where, like, I remember at the beginning, the first like prologue to my first novel was like this. It didn't come from me, Lizzie. Like, it's in my book and my name's on the cover, but that bit did not come from me. That came through me. Like, you know, and as writers, a lot of us will have had this experience too, where this just flowed. Everything came out perfect the first time. There was very little editing to be done. You go back weeks and months and, you know, years later, and you look at that and think, I can't believe I wrote that.
Yes. Yeah.
That's, no. Yeah. So what is the difference between those two times? Like, physically, we're not different. Physically, I've still got my brown eyes. I've still got my blonde hair. I've still got, like, you know, all of the things. It's the mind and the energetic that we're connected to, the frequency in which we're plugged into at that time, that determines how clear we can transmit the message. You know, what we're truly trying to say, whether we think about that as, like, you know, what's in our heart, it's an academic, what's the real argument, the real essence of the argument you're trying to make clearly, whether that's the creative kind of, you see it as, do you ever read Salman Rushdie's Sea of Stories?
No, I don't think I've read that one. No.
I'm not a big Rushdie fan, but he has this book called The Sea of Stories, which is almost like a child's book. And he imagines the writing process as like a tap. Some people have this magic tap. And at the beginning, the narrator's father throws down his pen for, I can't remember. I think his wife leaves him and he's in a depression. So he throws down his pen and says, I'm not going to write anymore. And in the night, like, I can't remember what it is, like a magic being comes and turns the tap off and the inspiration is gone. So whether you think it's like, you imagine there's this like field of inspiration and you channel it, or whether you're just trying to transmit something from your heart, you have to be in the energetic frequency that matches the message that you're trying to put out. And when you're not there, it comes out wrong.
Yeah. And you talk about flow, don't you, in your book as well? And I was wondering so the meditation is obviously a big part of that for you, getting into the flow, would you say?
Well, I mean, it did not used to be, in terms of, you know, sometimes it would happen and sometimes it wouldn't. And, you know, everybody says, we've all listened to a bunch of writing books, podcasts, all this kind of stuff now. And so we've heard everybody say, the flow, the creativity kind of comes more the more you sit down and write and do the work, you know, and I think that's true. But so I haven't really, until very recently, I haven't really used meditation as a way of getting into work. But I think there's a profound benefit to that being a method. It's hard to get into because it seems really unproductive to sit there for however long.
I think that's the problem, isn't it, for people who are kind of, I don't know, used to being like high achievers, striving to take that step back, which is actually going to be more productive. And I think for me, it's things like, I don't know, being out in nature, doing some gardening, just going and doing some weeding in my veg patch. You know, that's something that's actually beneficial sometimes and will actually help the writing, or that's when I'll have a brilliant idea.
Totally. And for me, I'm seeing this all through the lens of yoga and meditation a little bit, but there's this process that we're all engaged in tuning our energy, because, you know, we're mostly energy. Like, physicists know this is common knowledge. We are putting out frequency from our bodies. So it's nice because there's science behind this now, whereas it used to be just like esoteric yogi language. But we're tuning our energetic frequency, like which means like, how do you feel? We're tuning that all the time to everyone around us. That's why you go and talk to a friend who's really like negative and you feel absolutely empty afterwards, because there is an energetic exchange happening between the people that you're around or what you're doing all the time. And when we go out in nature, when we are, you know, with our pets, for instance, you know, when we're listening to music or listening to a really inspiring talk or being in a beautiful place, our energetic resonance is rising to match the energetic frequency of the things we're around.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're able to be in a different place.
I think that's
the mechanics of it, if you see what I mean. I think that's the mechanics behind I feel better.
I think so. Yeah. And so for me, it might be like, I don't know, going for a run or going for a swim in warm swimming pool water, followed by sauna, I should mention. But yeah, and I know that with my kids as well, if they're in a foul mood, you know, and the day seems to have gone really badly, I look at my own, how have I woken up and what's the energy that I've been projecting? And that's often reflected.
Totally. Yeah.
As we're talking about kids, from a kind of practical level, how do you manage to get so much writing done? How do you manage to be such a prolific writer with small children and all the rest of it, everything else going on?
Well,
do you have any process or routine?
Yeah, I'll give people the kind of overview of the whole story, because this is so important, Lizzie. Like, seeing how people are actually making it work for me is like so important, because we see a lot of people and we always think things are somehow easier or more in control with them. And it's not true. You know, when I wrote my first book called The Boatman, which is fiction, I was on a postdoc. And so I was teaching a few hours a week. I knew that I wasn't going to pursue an academic career. And so in the time when I should have been doing research and publishing things to get a, you know, proper academic job, I wrote my first novel. Mm-hmm. And that was pre-kids. And that's how that happened. And I self-published it. And then since kids, writing has not been something that's been regular. It happens in big spurts for me. I mean, there's a regular writing process that happens in my business now, and writing is an essential part of my business in the sort of messy, luminous being, yoga, meditation, well-being. But as far as books and big pieces of writing, that's much more sporadic. And actually, my second novel, I really got momentum during NaNoWriMo. So if you know, most people on this podcast will know, in November, they have this big national writers, what is it? NaNo.
Yeah.
The goal is to write 50,000 words in a month, which goes to about, 2,500 a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought one year, in November, I really find that it's a good time, because it's like the energy is going down. We're all like starting to get ready for winter. The leaves are, you know, the trees are pulling in their sap, and like we're doing that too. And so it's like, you know, I find writing big stuff in the summer quite hard. It's a real extroverted time, but November is great. And every year I always think that time of year, I'm like, ooh, I suddenly want to write more. That's how I got momentum. I was just like, one year I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get going on a second novel. And so I didn't finish the novel by any stretch, but I got that momentum that I needed.
Just getting a big chunk of it done, and you can see that it's kind of doable.
Yeah. Once you're in the middle of a project, it's actually fine.
Yeah.
Usually, if you can keep going, unless some big thing disturbs it, it's the getting going that's hard. And then, but that I did while my kids were at school. I was working part-time, you know, and I was teaching yoga, but there were days that I had that the kids were at school and I would drop the kids off at school and go straight to Costa Coffee. I would not go home, because as soon as I go home, all bets are off.
Yeah.
And I would go sit in the same Costa every day and get my one cup of coffee and, you know, write until I was so hungry, I had to go home for lunch.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. And it's amazing how much the words start adding up, isn't it? If you do something like that and you can get away from all the distractions of things that need doing at home.
Totally. Yeah. And, you know, some days, I would spend most of the time staring out the window, and some days were like amazing. But the more I did that, the easier it got to write those words. So like, you know, the first, do you ever run? Like, do you jog ever?
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like the first 7 to 10 minutes of any run, I mean, I don't run that much longer than that, but you know, are always the worst. It's like always the beginning where you're like, oh my God, this is awful. This is so hard. I'm never going to make 20 minutes. And then you get past like minute 7 and you're like, oh yeah, this is okay.
Yeah.
And
it's often just the starting, isn't it? Exactly. Yeah. I think you find that with running and writing. Yeah, that's why I like having, when we do meet for our accountability sessions, because sometimes first bit is, oh, right, okay, it's just sitting down to do it, do the first kind of 25 minutes. And then by the second 25 minutes, I'm really into it. You know, it's just the getting started. Yeah.
It's the getting started, totally. And creating some sort of, whether it's getting together with an accountability buddy on Zoom, which is like how we laugh about this all the time, you and me, but like how insanely productive is it just to have someone on a screen, not even in person, like just doing the same thing as you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or if it's like, this is, you know, but we're very susceptible to routine in many ways and to outside stimulus. And we can either allow these things to pull us off track, or we can harness them and use them to keep us on track. And so I think going to the same place on the same days, at the same time, for me, even if it, I mean, once a week. The other thing I should say is, I find when it's a big project, writing once a week when the kids were little was maddening, because I would, by the time that week is gone and you're back to your session again, you've forgotten the thread. You don't know where you are. It takes you most of the time you have to get back into it and remember what you were doing. So that's something to work with too. I think for people with young children or people with sporadic writing, I find if you can find at least 2 or 3 times a week, for especially for bigger projects, when you're not just writing a post, a blog post, an article, something small, if you're writing a book, you have to, it has to be, otherwise you'll
drive larger chunks, or more regularly. Yeah. And that thing I often talk about, you know, parking on a downhill, where at the end of a session, you're right wherever you've got to, so that when you come back into it, you don't go right to the beginning and start reading through everything you've written. You just know what it is that you're writing next. And I think especially if you've got small pockets of time, or like, you know, the kids are going to have a nap and you've got, you know, maybe an hour or 20 minutes, whatever it might be, to write then.
Yeah, totally. I think the other thing I've really noticed with myself over the course of the years of writing is, when I don't know what to say, it's because I haven't sat back and either thought or planned enough.
Yes.
So for any kind of more nonfiction stuff, I am a big planner. So whether that was like the PhD or, you know, any of the writing I've done, like for articles, or this Forward From Here book, I really kind of structured that out. And I knew what each chapter was going to be, what story example I was going to use, what notes from other books I was going to bring in. And when it was hard to write, I knew I hadn't done enough prep beforehand.
Yeah.
And the same with fiction. I felt like when I was, see, with fiction, my sort of process, again, I'm a big planner because my books are not, they're idea driven. They're not, you know, sort of, plot driven. So a lot of things have to come together, which means I need to plan things out in advance, and things have to make sense. And it's in a different world, so everything has to match up, what I've said before and what I'm saying now. So a lot of planning has to go in. But I also really underestimated at the beginning how long I needed to just dwell in a scene in my mind. I mean, maybe not everybody needs to do this because everyone's different, but I tend to plan out generally, like, okay, this scene is going to be this, and this has to happen, and this information has to be kind of, and we have to get the character to here. But then I spend a lot of time before I write just like imagining it in my mind. I sort of play it out like a movie. And sometimes people say, you know, I run dialogue in my head and I'm like, ooh, no, that's not what they can say. That sounds awful. Or, you know, the conversation will be going and at some point it becomes awful. And I'm like, okay, it was good up to then, but that can't be what they say, or that can't be what they do next. And I'll rerun the scene differently and see what different, and then I'll write. So I know when things are hard, it's really because I haven't like allowed myself the time to just dwell in it. And I think for people who are fiction writers, and maybe this works for nonfiction too, but have kids, this is the process that you can be doing all of the time.
Yeah, I know. I think that totally works for nonfiction as well. And you know, I often, yeah, as I say, when I'm not sitting at the computer, sitting at the screen, that's when I'm having the ideas, thinking about it. It's your brain working while you're doing other things.
Sometimes the writing is the last part of the process.
Exactly. And I think planning it out and having a really good structure, knowing what stories you're going to include, what examples, what research you need to put in, that really helps me anyway to get into the flow when I'm writing, because I don't need to be, it's separating those processes and really separating the outlining. You've got the outlining, you've got the writing, and then really separating that. That's what I find with people as well, is they're trying to do all three of the planning, writing and editing and proofreading 100%. At the same time, but they really need to be separate things, because yeah, otherwise the progress doesn't happen. I think
totally. And you know, for about 3 or 4 years I taught at a academic writing center at university. And that was totally the students' problem when they couldn't write. It was because they hadn't planned, but we do that all the time ourselves. And sometimes we think a bullet point plan is enough and we still can't write it, and you need to fill in that plan more.
Yeah.
You just need to plan it out until.
Yeah. It's like laying the solid foundations for a house, isn't it? It's the same kind of thing. You've got to have those foundations set, because yeah, if you don't do that, you're going to have to come back and do it anyway afterwards.
Yeah.
Because that's work that I've done with people kind of editing, you know, is that they'll come to me, they've got this draft and then it needs kind of pulling into shape because it hasn't got that backbone in it, which it needs. So yeah, that can be really helpful. Encourage that. I mean, I'm sure there are people that do it without everyone. As you say, everyone has their own process. But for me, I strongly recommend outlining and planning. Okay. So we've kind of talked a lot about writing. A lot of listeners are writing a book or writing an article for their business. So could you tell me, what are the benefits that you've seen of, I don't know, particularly this book or any writing that you do? You know, I know you've written articles and things. What benefits have they had for your business?
You know, a lot of the stuff that we do for our business is really part of a long game, you know, like podcasting is a perfect example. And I think with my business and my experience, you know, setting up my own business and I don't know, 3 years in or 4 years in, I would say that it's about, for me, a constant process of trying to find the things that are going to move the needle now and the actions I need to take to kind of get clients now, but also things that are part of the long game about getting people to know you, keeping up the relationship with you. I mean, one of the most important bits of writing that I do for my business is my emails. Mm-hmm. So I'm massively bought in to email marketing. I love writing, and I didn't used to. This has been a huge kind of process for me trying to get into writing emails, but I write every week. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they hear from me more than once, and that has established, and it takes a while, you know. Sometimes now this is like 3 years in, 2.5 years in to really being consistent about writing weekly. People are just coming out of the woodwork now that have been reading my emails, and sometimes not, for years. And I have the exact same thing with people that I follow. I read and read and read. Sometimes I buy, sometimes I don't buy for years.
Yeah.
And then it's the right time. So that's a huge part of my writing for my business. And the books, I think, it's so funny how people react to books. It's like, and especially because the gatekeepers aren't there anymore. So we can self-publish a book. It can look beautiful. People can get it on Amazon, and or you can get copies and bring to events or client meetings and stuff like that. And it, no one cares who published it.
Mm.
Literally no one cares if there's a publisher, who the publisher is. If you've written a book, you're on a whole different stratosphere in your business, in your field. So, you know, and I think the other thing is too, when you're online, people like to have a thing that they can hold or own that's part of you, that's part of like the feeling that they get when they're in connection with you and in connection with the information that you are transmitting. So that might be, you know, well-being stuff. That might be confidence in a certain aspect of business. That might be like whatever the feelings of it are, they want to be able to hold it. And so I think having a book, even if it's tiny, mm-hmm. is massive.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I think so. And I think it allows people to really connect with you and see your personality. I mean, reading your book, you know, things like about your swimming and the meditation. And the other thing we haven't talked about is that you talk about your camper van in there. So, you know, it really gives people an insight. And the other thing I just wanted to touch on about what you talked about is the long game. And I think writing is really useful for that, because what I really like about the writing that I do for my business is that I'm building up a bank, you know, even writing a blog post, even if it's once a month, or that's there, or an article that's going to be there and people can go back to it. And I just feel like so much of the other writing we do is just kind of gone. It just kind of vanishes, you know, on Instagram or whatever else.
Yeah.
And it's not there. Whereas the beauty of this, I mean, I've only been at it since, you know, 2020, but already I'm starting to build up a bank of things, and you know, like the podcast episodes, and that's going to be there. So people will be able, if they discover me later on, they'll be able to go back and have a look at that as well.
That's right. And you're not only building up a bank of words, you're building up, number one, you're getting clear on your messaging when you write.
Yes. Yeah.
Everybody.
Yeah.
You know, that's been huge for me. But also you're building up a bank of people who have connection to you. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, each piece that you write and put out is a potential bridge.
Yeah.
Somewhere yeah. else from that person that likes the way that you transmit your message to you. Yeah. And I loved a woman I listen to a lot says, you don't have to say something new. You just have to say something true.
That's
and,
right.
you know, we can get really caught up in, you know, that there's so many other people that do what we do, no matter what field it is. That's true for everybody,
yep.
you know, and what's helpful for me as someone who teaches meditation is I'm really clear that what I'm saying isn't new, like this tradition and the knowledge that I have to pass on to people goes back thousands and thousands of years and has changed and has developed over time.
Yeah. But that's fantastic. Yeah. Just really owning that aspect of joining the conversation, isn't it?
That's it. We stand on shoulders of people that came before us, and we take conversations forward. We develop, we get rid of some stuff. We bring stuff to the fore. You know, we all have people in our life that it's like, for some reason, the way that they explained the thing was the way that we needed to hear it.
Yeah, that's
we've
right.
heard that thing 1,000 times
yeah,
before.
Yeah.
That just didn't land somehow, and suddenly you're like, "Oh,
yes,
oh, that's what they mean by that," or "Oh, I get it." And you know, for everyone listening, like, you are that person with your message to other people.
Mm.
It doesn't have to be
new. That's it. That's why these things you hear about, oh, the secret too. And I mean, for me, you know, there's no secret about writing. Loads of people have taught writing really well, as you say, for kind of hundreds of years. It's a similar thing, you know, and then just the way that I then convey that might be different. It might resonate with some people in a different way. And the fact that people can then work with you you know, that someone else that said that thing before they might not be able to work with, but they can work with you as a teacher.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's something else that goes back to what I was saying about our frequency and what we're putting out into the world, because I just feel like we, you know, we all get caught up in that, like, I don't sound as good as other people.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, what I have to say is really boring. I've read 3, 4, 5 other books recently that say pretty much what I have to say. But you have a unique, it, like in writing, we call it voice, but you have a unique frequency or energetic, we can say. Like, you know, when you get around different people, you know, we all have people in our life, you get around them, you just feel good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so you have a very unique energetic, and sometimes that energetic is one of incredible compassion and understanding. Sometimes that energetic is like, I see you. You know, people, you're able to make people feel seen in the fields that you're in. You know, sometimes it's that you're really able to like motivate people. But whatever it is, I think people are looking for a certain energetic. They're coming to you. And what I really realized about yoga is that the people who had been coming to me in my class for years knew how to do the postures. There are only so many postures in yoga. You can only do them in so many combinations. At some point, you know what you're doing, and you're not coming to class for that reason anymore. You know, so then it made me ask, like, what am I actually giving people? Because they keep coming. So what is it? And I realized that, and this is true for all of us, we're not giving what we think we're giving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Most of what we're doing is just holding space and accountability for people to implement and do the thing that they really want to do, but can't quite manage themselves.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Because they can find the information about anything for free out there, can't they? They need someone to, you know, maybe help them through it, guide them, all of that stuff. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
Or inspire them, even motivate them in a different way, even if it's not a kind of one-to-one or small group setting.
So you're really, whatever your field is, whatever your business is, a lot of what you're doing is creating a space for people to feel that motivation and that accountability and that energy to implement. And I think the other thing is we are helping people retune to our energy. And that is something that we 100% discount in our business. But again, whatever your business is, you know, like writing coach, you know, yoga and meditation, there is an energetic frequency that is like sort of more ideal for people to be in order to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like if you're going to run a race, you're going to run a 10K, you can't like do the same thing when you have, you know, opera music in your ears than you can when you're pumping really like good beat music so that you can run to it.
Yeah,
you know, you don't run to meditation music.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what we're all doing is, and what our job really is, and this is true for our writing and our business, is trying to find the frequency of the message and the frequency or the energy that is needed, or the feeling, you could say. It doesn't have to be esoteric. It can be the feeling, the best feeling for the thing that you want to help people do. And so, you know, with writing, that might be calm, clarity, confidence. You know, with someone else, it might be like empathy, understanding, you know, inspiration. I don't know, whatever the feelings are that in your field you need to get people there.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what you're giving. So your message doesn't need to be brand new, but the message is the gold. The message is the gold. That's what translates into money, clients, connections, opportunities, everything. So our job is to get the message as clear as possible. That's our work. Everything else will sort itself out.
Yeah. And I think things like you were talking about, the fact that you've started writing your emails really consistently, and I've done exactly the same thing. And when I look back at the emails I started writing at the start, they're rubbish because I'm still, you know, and they're still not great. And I know that I'm still learning. I'm still really a baby business with everything I do. The emails I send out, the blog posts, the podcasts. Yeah. And I'm going to look back, hopefully, if I'm still at it, which I hope I will, and think, oh my goodness, what was that? You know, but the point is, I'm still out there trying, doing it, putting this stuff out, refining what I'm doing, refining my message, seeing what reaction I get. And if I didn't do that, if I just waited for those 2 years and hadn't put a thing out, I would be no better off than I would have been 2 years ago. So, I mean, that's, I think, the biggest thing that people can do to start refining their message is to take action, isn't it? I think.
Yeah. And, you know, just like we are trying to do what I just said for other people, we also need to do that for ourselves, which means if you're having trouble writing, you need to get yourself into a writing group or pay a writing coach or do something to get in connection with people that are going to help you get momentum.
That's right. You know? That's right. Yes. Okay. I feel like we could chat for hours and hours, but as I was telling you before, I'm really slow at editing, so I'm going to bring this to a close. Something that I ask all my guests is, have you got a book that you're currently reading or a book that you'd recommend to listeners?
I'm reading at the moment. You know, one of the books that I always come back to is Atomic Habits.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I reread that book so much, and I read on my Kindle. So, you know, I don't read in order. I just kind of skip around. And so, because I tend to go to books for, again, like, what energy do I need? What motivation do I need? Like a kick up the bum? Do I need inspiration? Do I need someone to just make me feel like I'm not alone and struggling?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And then you read something that kind of like helps you. And for me, Atomic Habits.
Okay. We've chatted about that one before on the podcast, so I'll link to it again. It's a highly recommended book. Okay. So, where can people find you? Where can they find your books? How can they follow your
Lizzie,
business?
I would love people to come find me and tell me what they thought about the podcast and if it helped them. That would be amazing.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, yes, everyone.
My Instagram is @SarahBHunt. And it makes me so happy when people come and tell me stuff. It's like it's like the best thing in my day when people like message me, isn't it?
Yeah, someone is out there listening and they make a difference.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So please, if you've listened all the way to the end, like, please come say hi. So Instagram @SarahBHunt. My website is sarahbhunt.com. Yeah.
Books on Amazon. Fab. Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining me, Sarah.
Lovely to be here, Lizzie. Thanks for having me.
This episode is sponsored by my blogging course for coaches, consultants, and educators, now live on the course creators platform Udemy and available at special offer to podcast listeners. Follow the link in the show notes and use the code BLOGGINGCOURSEPOD. If you've got anything you'd like me to talk about on the show, you know someone you'd like me to interview, or perhaps you'd like to be a guest, send me a DM on Instagram @DrLizzieTangi or email me lizzie@lizzietangi.com.